Thanks for tuning into the Glossy Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Priya Rao, Executive Editor at Glossy. And today's guest is Tarang Amin, the Chairman and CEO of e.l.f. Cosmetics. Welcome, Tarang.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks for being here. So, Tarang, you know, you've been at e.l.f. and been CEO for about 6 years now. Tell us a little bit about what was happening at e.l.f. when you first arrived as CEO.
Sure. So we acquired this company about 6 years ago. I was working with TPG, the large private equity company. And myself, as well as the founders, rolled in when we bought e.l.f. It had just reached about $100 million in sales, maybe about $17 million in EBITDA. And so we knew, and the company had been around for 10 years. So we knew that there was something real at the company versus sometimes a lot of beauty brands you see come and go. Having hit almost 10 years and the $100 million mark, we were intrigued, one, by the company, but more importantly, by the tremendous potential it had.
So what was happening in the larger beauty landscape at the time?
So beauty, it's one of my favorite sectors, having worked consumer for probably about 30 years, mainly because there's always a dynamic situation from terms of the category, in terms of the growth. And I would say when we, in 2014, when I came to the company, beauty was having a really good time. I would say growth rates were pretty strong, particularly in color cosmetics. And within that, e.l.f. was really well positioned. I mentioned that it was $100 million. It had been growing every year since its founding. It was really quite disruptive in the marketplace and yet had tremendous potential.
So what happened in 2018 when things started to slow down a little bit?
Sure. So I think, this is a brand, like I said, been growing every single year of its history. And even when we bought the company, I think we were growing at about 20% a year and, really executing well against the strategy. And then we're all a bit surprised in 2018, the brand actually declined by a couple points. And so for us, it seemed like death. And basically what happened is a lot of times what can happen on many brands, which is the success that got you to a certain stage, you kept replicating that and then had to find that there was something else that you needed to do. And specifically in 2018, we'd seen over, I'd say, the couple of years leading up to that, the rise of many of these mega influencer-driven brands, the Kylies of the world, the Fentys. I mean, you know all of them. And at first, I take accountability for it. When I saw those brands rise, many of them were priced above $20 per unit. e.l.f. has always been this brand that had the best of beauty, but made it accessible at these incredible price points. I think our average selling price is less than $5. And so when I first saw many of these mega influencer-driven brands, basically concluded that, e.l.f. probably is not going to get impacted by them because we're growing so fast. Instead, what we found was we absolutely were impacted, even though the price points were quite different. And because we appeal to these young, diverse makeup enthusiasts, many of them were getting their attention taken by what else was going on. So for the first time in 2018, we saw our organic search results on Google decline amongst 18 to 34-year-olds. And what we realized was we were losing relevancy. The fundamental proposition was still good, but we're getting drowned out by all the noise in the category.
Was that surprising for you from a business standpoint? Because, it is a younger customer. They don't have that much disposable income, and yet they're buying $20 lipsticks.
Well, I think it was both surprising and not so surprising. So surprising was how much we were impacted by what was going on in terms of the broader market. But what's not surprising is it's always about what engages and catches people's attention. And I think the immense amount of reach that many of those brands have or many of those influencers have, you could see this over time. And I think so from that standpoint, we shouldn't have been surprised, but certainly it impacted us.
So you set out in 2018 with a plan called Project Unicorn, which really kind of gained some steam these last 18 months. Talk to us a little bit about what that entailed for you.
Sure. So what Project Unicorn was about is really a fundamental redoing of our packaging, product, and our shelf presentation. When e.l.f. was first created and we first started having retail distribution, it was very MAC-like in its presentation. So it was this extraordinary value brand, as I said, less than $5 each, but looked like a prestige brand even in mass outlets. That elegant black packaging, the secondary packaging we had, as we started picking up more space because of our success, we're the most productive brand that a Target or a Walmart will carry. We started getting a lot more space, that elegant black packaging all of a sudden looked like this sea of black where you kind of was really hard to kind of navigate those shelf sets. So what Unicorn was really about is how do we really breakthrough, particularly in a very cluttered retail setting, and really allow our premium componentry colors to really shine through. So it was really removing a lot of that secondary packaging and then creating a shelving system that would really allow our consumers to navigate the shelves in a way that would drive retailer productivity.
How did that compare to what was happening in your own doors? You know, you had 22 standalone stores at one point. And part of this transition was also closing those stores last year, last February, around a year ago. So that was obviously a tough decision. But why make the play and make the gamble that, you know, this was the right move to make to be more productive in retail?
Well, I think whenever a business goes through a soft period, it really makes you step back and really reflect on what are the real strengths that you have and where do you really need to focus. So as you said, it was an extremely difficult decision closing our 22 e.l.f. branded stores. But the $13.7 million we're spending on those stores, we concluded was better invested in our digital initiatives and with our national retailers. And so far, that's really played out. So while difficult because it impacted a number of our associates, it's been the right thing to do from a business standpoint because we've seen that investment really pay much greater dividends across the rest of our business.
It seems like you guys were a little bit ahead of the curve because, you know, MAC is redesigning their standalone stores, Bare Minerals have closed stores and are redoing them. You know, what does that say about the landscape that, you know, you have to be in a place like a Target or a Sephora or Ulta or Amazon, like to really trade with the customer?
Well, I think part of it depends on what your business strategy is. And so for us, our mission is making the best of beauty accessible to every eye, lip, and face. And so it really is about accessibility and inclusivity amongst a broad consumer base. If you think of our e.l.f. stores, we only had 22. So it wasn't really meeting the objective of really making the brand accessible. Whereas, you know, we're in 5,000 Walmart doors, almost 1,800 Targets, 1,200 almost Ulta Beauty. And then we're still increasing our penetration in drugs. So that was more to our strategy of our overall mission. And then the second is this, we're a digitally native brand. We started online. It still is our main engagement vehicle. So making sure that we were being really focused on what was true to our brand, which is the combination of digital and broad exposure with national retailers, at least for e.l.f., made more sense.
With the retailer piece, you know, besides the packaging, besides the shelving, what else did you guys do to really revitalize these store environments?
Well, we came back to what our real superpower is, which is creating these prestige quality products at these unbelievable prices. We call them our holy grail first mass products. And it's something that e.l.f. uniquely does. And so as we looked at our business, we said, you know, this is what we uniquely do. But in 2018, we found ourselves caught in this trap of we're also very good at launching lots of new products and we can do it very fast. So we can, you know, in I think 2018, we launched almost 120 products.
Wild.
And we could do it in as fast as 13 weeks. And we got so into how many products we were launching and how fast we were launching, we took our eyes away from what was most important in those launches. And it's our unique ability to bring the best of beauty and make it accessible. So I'll give you a great example. In 2019, as we looked at what was going on in 2018, we really brought some of these first to mass innovations to market and put greater support behind them. So that increase in marketing support that we got from closing the stores gave us the fuel to really make prominent things like our poreless putty primer. So our poreless putty primer, $8, you know, compares, the only other thing like it in the market was Tatcha Silk Canvas at $52. Or if I think of our camo concealers, which also did incredibly well, the only other thing like it was a prestige item at $26. So it really got to the core of our overall competitive advantage and brand proposition. And those are the items that our retailers wanted, that our consumers wanted, and then being able to amplify them I think was a key aspect besides Project Unicorn and really making sure that we had success.
Will you talk about that magnification? Because, you know, some of that, what you're talking about, a lot of other beauty brands out in the market are paying for. You know, what you guys did with Poreless Putty Primer with influencers was all very much organic, word of mouth, discovery. How were you able to really tap into those, you know, faces and change makers in the market with, you know, something that you weren't paying for?
Well, the key for us, it's always been about our community. And I think, you know, this brand, when we first created, we're selling cosmetics over the internet for $1 each, right? Nobody thought that was possible. And the reason why we're successful doing it is our entire effort went against how do we engage with consumers, let them leave reviews on our site, be really responsive to it. So this community's grown over the years. And so our road to success always goes back through our community. And so the way we got that amplification was really going through and making sure our community knew about these products. They then clamored and actually asked and demanded some of the larger influencers to see. They were so enamored by these products that you got to review them. You got to compare them to the prestige equivalent. And so, you know, all the credit always for us goes back to our core community and our ability to reach out even better to them, which our doubling down on our digital investments definitely helped us do.
How is your foray into TikTok part of that?
Yeah, so our foray into TikTok was very much part of bringing the brand back to its roots. And this is a brand that was always been about experimentation, about trying, about having fun with our community. And so as we approach TikTok, I mean, we tend to skew pretty young from a millennial standpoint as our core target, and increasingly even Gen Z. We looked at what are the platforms that really resonate amongst Gen Z. TikTok came to our attention. And like anything else, we knew we didn't know what we wanted to do on TikTok. So we decided, learning from them, we ended up doing a brand challenge. And it's part of that collaboration and part of trying and experimenting with new things. We created an original song for our challenge. It was the first time that an original song had been composed for it. And then we watched the magic happen, that how it virally took off. And I think we're now up to over 4.4 billion views of our brand challenge, over 3.3 million user-generated videos. So it can really talk the power of kind of being open and experimenting and really letting kind of our community take over.
You know, it's been about a year that the turnaround plan has been in place for three successful quarters, including last week's earnings announcement of you guys being on the right track. How do you kind of make that continue to play forward? How do you continue that success? Because you have bested a lot of your competitors in the space.
Well, I think we got to stay true to those strategic imperatives that got us here and double down on many of them. And so if I look at those strategic imperatives of really driving demand in our brand, doubling down on digital, really coming out with these first-to-mass holy grail products, our ability to improve national retailer productivity, and then generate the cost savings that helps pay for all of that, I think there's a long way to go in all five of those strategic imperatives. So I'd say continue to execute against that first and foremost. I think the second thing is being open to how else do you drive different vectors of growth. So we've also talked the importance of pursuing strategic extensions. And these extensions, you know, we've made a series of investments in our team and our capabilities that we think can be applied to other brands, whether we did a small tuck-in acquisition in a different space or adjacent category, or created our own brand. And this, you know, our company is full of people that have lots of experience with multi-brands, and we believe that's another way of, beyond the e.l.f. brand, continuing to drive value.
When you think about those tuck-in acquisitions, are you thinking about AR, VR? Like, what are interesting areas that would be beneficial towards e.l.f.?
Well, I think interesting areas are brands that, you know, may have shown a promising start but lack the capability in terms of really expanding distribution, or may not have the level of sophistication we have in our operations or supply chain. And so brands that could really benefit from what e.l.f. could bring to it, and in turn, what e.l.f. could benefit in terms of a new capability or a new space that, you know, would take us a long time to develop, that we could get that right away. And so, you know, unfortunately, it's something that I can't really talk about, but we believe there's a lot of potential out there.
What about incubation? I mean, you're seeing a lot of these beauty brand incubators really kind of gain steam, whether it's the Maces of the world or the Beach Houses. What would make sense for the e.l.f. portfolio?
Yeah, I think our ability to take these superpowers that I talk about are an unbelievable quality at these extraordinary prices, our supply chain and operations advantage, our distribution capability, and really be able to say, can we collaborate with someone or incubate our own brand that could leverage that, perhaps in a different price tier, perhaps in a different category. So that's also of interest to us.
You mentioned a second ago your supply chain. Obviously, you guys have a pretty large distribution and supply chain in China. Talk to us a little bit about, you know, growing that operation, whether it means with distributors or more retail accounts or even just the presence you have there.
Yeah, so our first focus in China is, you know, a lot of our operational advantage comes from there. I mean, we've been in China for 16 years. It's not a sourcing office. It's true multifunctional expertise across R&D, quality, sourcing, the entire spectrum, and our ability to really get the best combination of cost, quality, and speed. It's our quality people in these facilities. It's our ability to plan long-term with them. So I'd say the first focus for China is it does bring our ability to deliver high quality at this extraordinary price. I'd say the second focus for China for us is really e-commerce. We're manufactured in country. We can go through a special regulatory approach that allows us to sell on e-commerce in China, guaranteed without having any animal testing. Cruelty-free is such an important value to us as a brand that I think, you know, China is the world's largest e-commerce market, ends up being a really big opportunity. So I think those are the two main opportunities for us. I don't foresee retail in China just because we don't have those assurances yet on cruelty-free. We work very closely with PETA and other people who are like-minded on our cruelty-free stance. And we think there's a lot of potential in e-commerce and are still in the early days there.
What does your presence look like there?
So right now we're on many of the third-party sites. So if I think of Tmall, JD, et cetera, in the last quarter, we made an important move. We used to have a distributor for our e-commerce business in China. We ended up taking that in-house, mainly to be able to get greater control of kind of marketing, our pricing, our new product launches. We did something similar in the UK a few years ago and have seen great results. And so I'm really hopeful of that move and what that will enable.
What do you think is so unique about the Chinese market in terms of e-commerce versus the U.S.? You know, obviously there's a whole other ecosystem in terms of, you know, distribution and influencers. It's like a totally different game almost.
Yeah, no, I love it in a way because if I think about the leap from China e-commerce as the world's largest e-commerce market, I think there's an entire skipping of a number of steps or generations that happened there. So if I look at kind of particularly on mobile, just how savvy consumers there are on mobile, how much the ecosystem really supports that and the immediacy of it, really I think is a good litmus test for what we probably expect to see in the U.S. even more of in the future. I'm now starting to see the same thing in India, where it used to be you needed to have a massive infrastructure to penetrate all the different villages and rural areas in India, and you know the speed at which you have the adoption of e-commerce and mobile and what that enables is really exciting for brands like us, which really have their roots direct to consumer.
How do you think international play out on a more global scale for you guys? Are there other regions you're very actively looking into, whether it be India, Australia? What's on your mind?
Yeah, so first and foremost for us was entering the UK a few years ago, and we've really been pleased with the results there, both at Superdrug, which was our initial customer, and now we're starting to roll out the brand in Boots, as well as our own site. So the UK becomes a pretty good roadmap for how we approach other countries, which is going direct to headquarters, really establishing ourselves both from a digital standpoint as well as with some of the leading retailers in a country and expanding there. I don't think you'll ever hear us talk about, you know, going to 20 countries at the same time. I think we like this disciplined approach of really making sure that we're entering a country the right way with the right retail partner and then going from there. So we're testing the brand right now in Germany. We think there are a number of countries in Western Europe that make a lot of sense. I mentioned China as our main focus for kind of Asia. I think India soon after that from an e-commerce standpoint. And then I think as we do that, we'll see where else we go.
Global domination?
Yeah. I don't think yet, but we definitely have massive amount of white space internationally.
last year, you and I spoke a little bit about the tariff situation in China and how that affected your pricing structure. You know, there's a lot of other global issues we're dealing with right now, whether it's Brexit in the UK or coronavirus in China. How are you able to navigate all of these like competing, almost global issues in terms of your own disciplined approach?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, it goes down to the strength of our team. So, you know, one of our great luxuries is out of 240 employees, we've hired 230 of them. So we've been able to handpick almost every single person in the company. And it really has two different dimensions. We tend to hire from blue chip academy backgrounds, but people want to move at a faster speed and like-minded that way. And then second is we really try to do the best we can to make sure our employee base represents the consumers that we serve. So I'm proud of the fact that 85% of our employees are women. 75% are millennial, over 60% are diverse, the consumers that we're seeking to serve. And I think the combination of both those things, kind of the diversity that we have, as well as kind of the sophistication, allows our team to navigate a constantly changing world. Because I think that's the one thing that we can count on is it's not going to be the same. And so whether I look at tariffs of just how well our team did, looking at what a tariff impact would be, what instead of peanut buttering, pricing across all of our SKUs, which items do we have the best value, which ones did potential competitors have to take pricing on, and basically apply it there allowed us to have much better pricing execution than what we even modeled. If I think of coronavirus, you know, my thoughts and first and foremost on our colleagues and our suppliers in China, just how well everyone's collaborating to kind of get through that situation. It's still way too early to really see what the full impact is. But I think it's that confidence I have really in our team and our ability to be in this high-performance team mindset that allows us to navigate each of those challenges.
Do you think that your gross margin increases from the last quarter are really due to those price increases because of the tariffs? Because so many of your competitors were saying the end of the year was going to be a bad quarter in color cosmetics specifically.
Yeah, so definitely pricing helped us with our gross margins. We didn't see the full tariff impact through all of our inventory, so our ability to take pricing was a driver. But it's also this balanced approach. We also spent quite a bit of time on our cost savings. FX certainly helped. And, you know, we saw that one-time benefit from FX, for example, and margin accretive innovation. All four factors really help drive our gross margins. We also want to make sure that we don't get too greedy on gross margin. We're an extraordinary value brand, so I think that's always a great balance point for us to make sure we're making progress, but also investing in the quality and price of our products.
Tarang, you've also moved slowly but surely into skincare more as of late. And, you know, that also is coinciding with this softening that we've seen the last year in color cosmetics. How have you guys fared with that? You know, in the larger scope of things, is skincare going to represent more product innovation in 2020 to offset this? Or what are you thinking in that regard?
Yeah, skincare has been a great success for us. So we entered skincare, as you said, about 3 years ago. In the last quarter for track channels, you know, our skincare business was up 35%. So clearly seeing very fast growth, but a long way to go. We've been at Color Cosmetics almost 16 years. We're about 3 years into skincare. The genesis was important. It really does meet our model of being able to bring the best of beauty and make it accessible. The same is true with our skincare line. We're seeing great results on items like our Holy Hydration Cream, our hydrating booster drops, things that really bring much higher level of quality at these great, great prices. And so skincare has been a pretty big component of our innovation pipeline, and I think you'll continue to see it get even more prominence.
So when you look forward into 2020, and we've talked about so many plans this year already, Tarang, what, you know, is coming to mind for the next quarter? What are you thinking about? You know, where do you want to be a year from now?
Yeah, so I want to be the same place a year from now that I want to be every year, which is really continuing to disrupt kind of the beauty marketplace by being able to engage our consumers, bring them products that nobody else can bring them, and demonstrate the level of growth this brand has seen for a very long time.
And what about the overall landscape? What are you expecting? Are we seeing a recession? Are we not seeing a recession? What do you think about like the overall competitive space? Is it thinning out?
Well, I think it's going to continue to be quite competitive. I mean, we've seen a number of new brands launch. I don't see that slowing up. I also see a category that's still going to be relatively soft compared to our long track record. So I think there's still some headwinds that we're going to have to deal with. But as long as we keep executing on what we're doing and capable of, particularly on these strategic imperatives, I feel we're well positioned.
Thank you so much, Tarang. It was great having you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Glossy Beauty Podcast. Our theme music is by Otis McDonald. Tune in next week for another episode. And if you know someone or more than one who should be listening to the Glossy Beauty Podcast, please have them subscribe. See you next week.